Welcome to Friend of Marilyn. My name is Kat Pause, and this is a fat-friendly space. Today on Friend of Marilyn, I share a great piece written by members of No Lose. I've been wanting to share this for a while, and I'm glad I finally found the time. I chat with Melissa McEwen from Shakesville, and I spotlight a blog from Fierce Fatties on No More Excuses. The show this week, I would like to share a really important piece that's recently been published by No Lose. The piece is titled A Response to White Fat Activism from People of Color in the Fat Justice Movement. I'd like to read this piece in its entirety because I believe that it's very important. Quote, "This letter is written to our fat community to express great concern over what appears to be a growing divide among us. We continue to see fat activism growing and our community expanding. And while this brings great joy, it also becomes more and more apparent that we are not doing the work to prevent our community from being divided along race and socioeconomic lines. We are not having the hard conversation needed to build the truly solid foundation of inclusivity and diversity that we rest much of our argument of anti-oppression upon. This is particularly important since both government programs and the diet industry have been specifically singling out and targeting people of color in recent campaigns. From Michelle Obama's selection of Beyoncé Knowles as the face of her national campaign against obese children, to the disproportionate number of children of color represented in the state of Georgia's Strong for Life campaign, the face of the obesity epidemic in public policy has largely become people of color. Similarly, the diet industry has focused several of its most recent national advertising campaigns around African-American celebrity icons, including the selection of Janet Jackson as a representative of Nutrisystem and Charles Barkley and Jennifer Hudson as spokespeople for Weight Watchers. While fat activism in the United States continues to be predominantly white, there is an emerging wave of fat people of color activists moving out into all aspects of our community. Joining with fat POC activists who have been working for years to create space for the unique challenges faced by POC within our mainstream diet culture, this has the potential to be a time of enormous shift in the perception and face of fat activism in the U.S. We are excited to be a part of this paradigm shift and to see more of our experience reflected in the work of fat activism. We hold grassroots events, organizing in high regard, because we know from experience that having established relationships with individuals aids in activating their enthusiasm for a project. While this is true, it also limits the reach of our work to our personal networks and circles. This is especially troublesome in the world of social media platforms like Facebook. Sending out an invitation for all contacts to participate is not the same as doing the thoughtful work of being inclusive, which requires planning, communication in groups, and transparency. Blanket invitation through social media or crowd surfing returns a large response from those already closely related to the issue, who often share the initiator's stance, privileges, and power. This can be seen in the recent Stand for Kids campaign, most recently renamed the I Stand Against Weight Bullying campaign launched by Marilyn Wan. This campaign is a great example of a provocative and direct action within the fat community, created to address fat shaming and body prejudice aimed at the children of Georgia through positive images of people of all sizes. The Georgia campaign Strong for Life features a high number of children of color and is being primarily aimed at children of color in Georgia's poor neighborhoods. The primary organizer of Stand for Kids, I Stand Against Weight Bullying, does not share these lived experiences. And while that truth does not mean that the organizer should not leave the project, it does raise a flag that the difference in experience between the organizer and the communities being addressed must be bridged in order to develop authentic and lasting relationships. Because the campaign launched through a crowdsourcing technique on Facebook, many of the first respondents were similarly white fat activists. As the campaign grew, it was reposted numerous times by many other white fat activists, none of whom were publicly critical of the lack of representation in the images and in the campaign's design and implementation. At that time, a group of POC fat activists began to discuss their disappointment at both the campaign and lack of critical response by the larger fat community. A person of color raised questions on the Stand for Kids Tumblr about the tools used to make the project inclusive, the intent and possible effect of the projects in communities of color, and the ways in which these images would be used to support children of color in Georgia. The response was disappointing. These discussions had not happened within this project, And the commenter was told that if they wanted to support diversity within the project, they, as a person of color, should join the project's Facebook page and offer solutions. More recently, the organizer of the campaign did address this post concern to acknowledge that the proper outreach had not been done and that she would take the questions posed on board. As the project has grown and moved outside of its immediate sphere of contact, more and more people of color have begun to participate. To date, the images on the Stand for Kid, I Stand Against Weight Bullying campaign site are still predominantly white individuals. Our critique of this campaign is not intended to imply that the campaign should not exist, that the organizers should not do the work, or that the images that have been created will not be effective in inspiring residents of Georgia to oppose the Strong for Life campaign. We offer this critique as one example of a fat activist action moving forward into a campaign without initial discussion of the inclusion of, or impact to, the communities it seeks to serve. Luckily, conversations can happen at many points during a movement, and there are countless opportunities for growth, connection, and coalition. The time has been long coming to again address the prevalent attitudes of socioeconomic privilege and white-centric thought in fat activism. When open and authentic conversations about race and class fail to happen, we see these attitudes in the ways that people are left out of conversations. We see people who live with great privilege speaking as authorities on the impact of racism and classism without basing their approach in the ally mode. We see large-size acceptance campaigns launched without coalition among diverse groups, thoughtful discussion around inclusivity, or well-versed allies on hand to help answer questions and facilitate community conversation. We see white allies heavily depending on POC and poor people to discern, direct, and implement the work of addressing these concerns within our communities only after or in response to work being presented that does not include their voices. We see white allies responding defensively and closing down conversations when presented with clear questions about taking steps to do their own work of finding ally mentors, addressing their own acknowledged and unacknowledged privilege directly affects members of their community, and engaging in thoughtful dialogue about the interconnectedness of oppression and the diverse ways those oppressions affect different members of our communities. Overly simplified analogies of power and privilege are no longer the face of fat activism. We, as a large and diverse community with a vast wealth of life experiences and resources, can do better. We can go deeper. We can form authentic and strong coalition with one another. White allies of the fat justice movement, flying by the seat of your pants when it comes to addressing the real concerns and questions around diversity and inclusion of POC in fat activist spaces or campaigns will no longer be good enough. POC and the fat justice movement deserve thoughtful and clear discussions around not just the intention of diversity and inclusion in the work you wish to do, but also the actual impact of the work within communities of color. POC and the fat justice movement demand and deserve that white fat activists build authentic collaborations with communities of color and work as allies. POC and the fat justice movement demand and deserve allies showing up to the table of our campaigns and work, rather than constantly being told they have to make a place for us at theirs. POC and the fat justice movement clarify that our allies will practice doing the work of learning about the histories and impacts of colonization and oppression on people of color, seek other allies to learn from and with, be open to dialogue, taking feedback, and allowing people's firsthand experiences of racism to be the final and authoritative voice on the subject of impact to communities of color. POC and the fat justice movement offer that through the work of authentic inclusivity, singular vision will become shared vision. Coalition will happen. Bridges will be mended and built. We are looking forward to a stronger, more representational expression of fat community in which POC and poor people's voices are heard, their experiences are respected, and their work to strengthen their individual communities is supported just as they work to support others. Please join us. End quote. Today is Melissa McEwen, founder of Shakesville, a progressive social justice blog that focuses on feminism, anti-racism, queer rights, and fat activism. Melissa, thank you so much for coming on Friend of Marilyn.
Thank you for having me.
So I have to admit, I'm a huge fan of yours, and I've been reading your work, it feels like for forever. And actually, most recently on the show, I shared your piece, Big Fat Love, which was such a great piece. And I think that it really spoke to a lot of people in a really lot of unique ways.
Oh, thank you so much. It's kind of strange that that's a radical concept. Right. I like that people, but it is. Yep.
And it doesn't seem strange to us, but I'm sure it really does seem strange to other people.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, and I have to admit, actually, like, I don't know about for you, but I know that for me, kind of learning to not just like fat people, but actually be able to, like, appreciate the fat body has been actually a process for me, in the sense that when I first kind of started on my, you know, journey, if you will, to acceptance and activism and blah, 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 I would still have that internal, like, cringe, like, ugh, you know, by not only my own fat body, but other fat bodies as well. And it's been a real process for me to get to the point where now I look at, you know, something that Substantia throws up and I'm like, damn, that's hot, or hey, that's awesome.
Yes, yes, absolutely. I mean, I think part of the thing about big fat love and saying, like, you know, I like fat people is also, you know, saying I like myself, which is also a radical concept,
right.
You know, yeah. to be a fat person who says, you know, I like myself, like, and I like, you know, my fat body, and I don't feel weird about that, you know.
And I like myself right now, not like I like myself and it'll be even better once I'm, you know, thinner or once I change something about my body. But I like who I am right now and I'm not looking to change.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. I mean, that is not a place that I've always been, for sure.
Well, I definitely know that for me in my own journey, the stuff that you and others write on Shakesville have definitely helped me, you know, as I kind of work through my own stuff, because you're so very honest, and oftentimes willing to kind of tackle issues that other bloggers necessarily aren't.
Yeah, well, we do definitely at Shakesville consider that fat is a feminist issue and also a social justice issue in many other ways. Especially, it's a class issue in the United States, particularly,
right,
and elsewhere. So it's definitely a social justice issue with which we're concerned.
What was the inspiration for you for founding Shakesville?
Well, Shakesville was originally founded as Shakespeare's Sister. It was the original name, which is a Virginia Woolf reference.
Right.
We have a Smith song.
Right, yeah.
originally, it was founded because it was right before the 2004 election, so right before George Bush's re-election, and I was complaining about it a lot. And my husband said, oh, you know, you should start a blog. And I said, oh, okay, I think maybe I'll do that. And so that's really how it started, because I was irritated with the election. And it didn't start out originally as a specifically feminist space, but it quickly became that way out of necessity. Because it's hard to be, a female blogger without being a feminist blogger if you actually don't want to have, misogynist slurs and so forth in your comments.
Right. Well, you know, one thing that I always notice about Shakesville as a feminist blog that often makes it different from a lot of the other feminist blogs that I tend to like is that there's a lot of feminist blogs that I really like, but I often find them not necessarily safe spaces for me as a fat person, because I can go into them and there's often good stuff about, like, bodies and body autonomy and acceptance and great queer stuff and even sometimes addressing issues of, like, ableism. But there's still often stuff that I would call anti-fat that, like, pops up. And it, of course, shocks me often every time. I don't know why. Like, it still shocks me. But I'm kind of going along and I'm like, yeah, this is awesome. And then bam, like, oh, right. I'm not okay here. This isn't a safe space for me. I was fooling myself to think that it was. But that doesn't happen at Shakesville.
Right. Well, I'm so glad to hear you say that you do feel like it's a safe space to be a fat person at Shakesville. And we do try to make it as safe as possible for as many people as possible, but certainly not allowing anti-fat rhetoric in the comments is a central part of our safe space policy. When I see other feminist bloggers sort of championing, like the First Lady, for example, Michelle Obama's Let's Move campaign,
right,
is very, I'm very positive on, giving as much access to fresh food and healthful food and nutritious food as possible. Obviously, I support all of that, but, some of the language in which that is couched is first of all, inherently ableist in that not everyone can move.
Yes.
And also, there's a big problem with any sort of rhetoric that talks about eliminating obesity.
Right. Yeah, it's very fatphobic.
Right. As I've written before, you know, to get rid of my fat body, you have to get rid of me.
Yeah.
Because I'm not going to be thin ever. Like, it's just not going to happen. So, you know, when you say that you want to eliminate my obesity, you're really talking about eliminating me as a person.
Yeah.
It's the only way that's going to happen. And that's true for a lot of fat people. You know, a lot of people who have, you know, disability, who have yo-yo dieting, who have, you know, disordered eating, all kinds of reasons. You know, when I see that, you know, yay, champion the Let's Move campaign without sort of examining how that anti-fat person is problematic. Or sometimes I've seen in other progressive spaces, you know, rah-rah for, like, Mayor Bloomberg of New York City has passed this ban on sugary drinks of a certain size.
Oh, right, yeah.
You know, so some of these things are, you know, not great. And the sort of, you know, reflexive, like, well, what difference does it make? All sugary drinks are terrible for you. And, well, yes, except unless you're, you know, a diabetic who's, you know, insulin is too high and you need a sugary drink immediately. You know, like, there's no such thing as an intrinsically good or bad food.
Well, and even if there was, the idea that, you know, it's up to someone else to then determine for you whether or not you should be allowed to imbibe or ingest something that is inherently good or inherently bad.
Right, right. There's that. There's an agency issue. There's also the issue that it plays to the narrative that the reason that everyone is fat is because of they drink too much soda.
Yeah.
You know, without looking at the fact that, like, you know, corn subsidies, you know, high fructose corn syrup being in everything from yogurt to bread, you know, I mean, it's in everything.
Well, and the assumption that it's only a problem when fat people do it. So I held a conference here earlier this year, a Fat Studies conference, and ended up doing a lot of media for it. And on one of the morning shows here in New Zealand, one of the presenters got really flustered, you know, at my suggesting that, like, being fat isn't the worst thing ever. And she, you know, kind of sputtered out, you know, but surely it's kids drinking fizzy drinks is a problem. And I smiled and I said, well, I said, you know, if we want to have a health conversation about whether or not kids drinking fizzy drinks is a problem, I said, that's a very different conversation. Because why is it only a problem if it's the fat kids drinking fizzy drinks? Like, why aren't we worried about the non-fat kids? And she kind of just, you know, blinked at me and then turned to her co-presenter and they carried on with something else about, you know, who will think of the children.
Right. Well, and I think that there's a certain, when everything is couched in an anti-obesity frame as opposed to a pro-nutrition frame,
right,
then, you know, everyone who isn't showing a quote-unquote lack of healthfulness through obesity is not, you know, there's no concern for them.
Right.
So, you know, if there's a thin child who is severely malnourished, does it matter? As long as they're not fat?
Yeah.
So, and the same thing for adults, you know, like, what if someone is thin because they have extreme hyperthyroidism that's, you know, dangerous? So focusing on fatness as opposed to, you know, nutrition.
As opposed to actual health.
Not really serving anybody.
Yeah. So what do you think the importance is of having safe spaces like the ones that you guys provide at Shakesville?
Well, I think the thing about having a safe space is that, you know, the idea was originally that, you know, I felt like when I would discuss politics in, this is before I had my own blog, in the comments, you know, I was a commenter at other blogs, America Blog and Eschaton and some other places. And, you know, there were some spaces in which, like Daily Coast, for example, there was a very famous situation where, you know, the founder, Marcos, said, you know, I'm not going to kowtow to the women's studies set. And, you know, there were times when it would be like, well, you know, we're trying to bring a different perspective here. And that was just really shouted down. So the idea in, you know, trying to create a commenting policy that makes for as safe a space as possible. And, you know, even I have undermined the safe space for other people. So it's not perfect.
Right.
You know, that's the goal, you know?
Yeah.
But, you know, we try to do the best that we can. The idea is that, you know, every voice is equal. So there's no one who's getting, you know, allowed to, like, shout down someone else using, you know, slurs and demeaning language and, you know, dog whistling and, you know, that sort of thing that then means that it's the same group of voices that are allowed, you know. And so the more that we started enforcing that, and it's grown over time. I mean, before, for example, like, I used to use the word lame. Like,
right.
In casual, you know, something equivalent to, oh, that's stupid or uncool, like, that's lame.
Yeah.
And someone pointed out to me, no, that's actually an ableist term. And I thought, you know, that's completely right. And so I stopped using it and added that as another thing to the commenting policy. And so, you know, it's grown over time to be more and more and more inclusive. And, you know, every time that sort of happened, like, every time I draw, like, a new boundary, you know, I get pushback on it, and people keep saying, you know, that's going to, you know, really undermine the conversation in Shakesville. You know, it's going to limit it. But in fact, the opposite happens, which is that people who feel like they can't comment anywhere else, who can't identify and say, like, I'm speaking from the perspective, say, of a trans woman, you know, they can't identify that way. They can't bring that perspective to another progressive blog that won't actually protect them. Then, you know, they actually have a voice at Shakesville, and therefore it's more diverse. There's, you know, a greater diversity of contributions to the space.
Well, I think that's actually a good place for us to wrap. Thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. It was really nice to talk to you.
Well, I hope that you will come back again sometime in the future.
I will.
Okay, great. Thanks. Spotlight today is a piece from Fierce Fatties. This piece is entitled No More Excuses and was published on May 21st, 2012. Quote, in the minds of fat-hating trolls, fat people are always looking for excuses to be fat, and fat acceptance enables them to do just this. Fat acceptance itself is the ultimate excuse for the massive human failure that is being fat. Uncommon sense should tell us all loud and clear that we are not currently witnessing an epidemic of people looking for reasons to get or stay fat. There are no cultural privileges, none, that come with being fat. If you are born fat, you are immediately cast into one of two roles, the hopelessly diseased or the would-be thin victim of evil parents. If you get fat later in life, you are both too lazy to do the work and too stupid to realize how good you had it. It's like not cashing in on a winning lottery ticket. Fat people are to blame for all the world's problems, have every disease known to mankind, and it is all caused directly by their fat. What are the cultural privileges of being fat again? That's what I thought. And nothing. And nada. Yet fat people still are accused nonstop of making excuses to be fat. I very often have this conversation with my mother, and in many of these, she will accuse me of making excuses to be fat. I tell her calmly that I'm not making excuses, I'm just fat. To me, making excuses for fatness is making statements along the lines of, I know I'm fat, but I don't have time to exercise. I know I'm fat, but I don't have the time to cook or the money to buy the right foods. I know I'm fat, but I'm depressed and I don't have resources to get help for my overeating. These are all statements that reflect the idea that A, you are fat, B, this is a problem, and C, that you cannot stop being fat because of some external factor and that people should stop blaming you. You are looking for an excuse to be fat without being judged too harshly, for being fat and not giving your life toward the pursuit of thinness. How about I'm fat? Full stop. I'm not explaining away my fatness or my failure to fix it. It just is. I'm not blaming anyone else for anything because there's nothing to blame on anyone. It just is. This is what fat acceptance tries to do, and this is exactly the opposite of making excuses. Fat acceptance is not an excuse to not care for oneself either. In a way, fat acceptance purports to do just the opposite. The health at every size approach requires that people chart their own course for well-being as opposed to just following mainstream, simplistic, one-size-fits-all health advice, often in the face of great opposition. Fat acceptance does not require that you pursue health, of course, but this is not making excuses either. Again, we are not blaming other people or society for our choices or for our health. It just is, and we demand respect regardless. Frankly, they are the ones making excuses, not us. They are making excuses and devising strawman arguments to ignore us and refuse to challenge their own bodies. They may be trying to deflect their insecurities about themselves onto fat activists. The reasoning goes, I hate myself as a fat person. I am working hard and succeeding at being a thin person, and someone somewhere doesn't appreciate how special I am because of it. If the issue can be framed as fat people giving up, the fear of the loss of cultural privilege stays safely out of sight and out of mind. In addition to accusing us as making excuses, these people very often use the excuses outlined above, like not having time to cook. It is like they are trying to say they know how bad being fat is, but please not shun them. They are pleading for approval. We are not. The next time you are accused of making excuses to be fat, just ask them, why should I excuse that which doesn't need excusing? I'm just fat. End quote. Thanks for listening to another episode of Friend of Maryland. Friend of Maryland is brought to you by Access Manawatu 999 AM. If you'd like to contact the show with questions, comments, concerns, or suggestions for topics or guests, please email us, friendofmaryland@aol.com. You can also find Friend of Maryland on Twitter and Tumblr. Closing the show is The Donnas with Who Invited You?